Stop. Talk to me. Grant Oliphant,
yeah.
How are you today?
Crystal Page, I'm excellent. Thank you. And I just want to note for folks who are just joining us for the first time after hearing last season that Crystal, with whom I'm privileged to work, has joined me as a co-host of the podcast. And we're taking the opportunity now to open and close with some reflections about what we've heard and who we've spoken with.
I'm so excited.
Welcome.
Thank you, Grant. I'm so excited to be here with you. I love our work on Stop and Talk, the podcast. And I have to say I'm thrilled today because you interviewed a Southeast San Diego hero.
Yeah, what a joy. The whole conversation was such a joy. And I think the listeners will be, no matter what, will be lifted up by what they hear. So we spoke with Diane Moss, who is the CEO and co-founder of Project New Village. That's a community organization which fosters food sovereignty in Southeast San Diego. And she is a community organizer, activist, transformer, dreamer. She denies being a visionary, but boy, she's dedicated her career to being a visionary, wouldn't you say?
I 100% agree. And we had the privilege of awarding her the Leaders in Belonging Award from the Prebis Foundation this year because she's kind of a big deal. She has vision. She brings people together.
Yeah, and actually, it's one of the ways we came to interview her today was just because of the Leaders in Belonging Award and how we experienced her in the course of that. You played a major role in administering that program and finding Diane as a recipient. What I can tell you is she deserved the recognition, and our listeners will see why.
Let's jump in.
Okay, let's do it. All right, Diane Moss, thank you so much for being with us here.
Thank you. It's a privilege being here.
Well, it's a joy having you. I'm going to start maybe in a place you weren't expecting, but you know we're going to talk about, so it's okay. So the place I want to start is you were one of the Prebis Foundation's inaugural Leaders in Belonging. And this is an announcement we made a few months ago where we identified five leaders in the community who are really demonstrating through their work a commitment to making San Diego a community for everybody and doing it in dynamic ways with different audiences. And we were delighted to have you among that group. So I want to start by asking you, what's it been like?
Can I just say the first week, just my regular neighbors, people I work with, I got phone calls and emails saying, thank you for lifting up our community. Thank you for representing us well. I didn't expect that. I didn't know who this announcement, who hears what, but that was overwhelmingly a good thing. We're pushing a new agenda, this urban ag in our neighborhood,
right.
And everybody's not in favor. So to hear people come out and say what I was doing for this geographical space, I felt good, but I also felt I have an obligation to move further. Opportunities are coming our way, and we're taking advantage of those opportunities to revitalize this community of southeastern San Diego.
That actually gave me goosebumps when you said that, to hear that was the reaction you got, and from friends and neighbors and people maybe that you just saw on the street. What do you think they meant when they were saying, thank you for lifting up our community? Why was that important to them?
So I live in a community historically has been disinvested, that people feel that people haven't looked out for them. I live in an area where people can look at their loans with their papers and see that black folks weren't supposed to live there and somebody else had to help them get in. So redlining is a part of our history.
Right.
So to be recognized for doing good things or making good things happen in this area, it resonates for people in the area. These are my neighbors. I've lived in this community since the 80s, and people have watched our journey. And it's not always been a frontline journey. We just do the work every day. We enjoy working together. But now there's some recognition that this is a good thing that we're doing. And it connects us not only together in the neighborhood, but people outside of our neighborhoods can see some of the assets that we have here in this space.
You know, what strikes me is the foundation created the Leaders in Belonging program because we wanted to inspire other people with stories like yours. What I didn't think about is that it can also be inspiration for people who are working alongside you and in the community where you're working. So let's talk about that work, because now let's come to really the beginning of the story about you and what you do. Can you talk to us a little bit about your organization and how you got into it?
So again, I say I lived here. I moved in the community in the 80s. I then ran another nonprofit working with children, and an opportunity came along to look at working together in a collaborative fashion to revitalize our community. This was back in 1994. So we started working to bring children home, particularly African-American children who had been separated. Their families are separated, so bringing them, trying to reunite them in the community. But then 2008 came, and I was at a conference for nonprofit people, organizations, and I sat next to a woman. She is currently the head of Food Shed and Solidarity Farm up in North County. She impressed upon me that food justice was a social justice issue. That in our neighborhoods, were we satisfied with the food we were getting? And I had never thought of this. I'm from South Central Los Angeles, and I figure food wasn't a social issue. You get what you get.
Right.
But then when I could see that decisions were made that were not in our best interest, I'm a community organizer. I figure that's where my skills were, to convince people that we were worthy and that we should have the same programs, the same access to good food and other basic services as anyone else. But in order to get that, we needed to work together, and we had needed to have skin in the game. So around 2011, we had an opportunity to start a community garden. I talked to my neighbors, two things they wanted in the neighborhood, a community garden and a farmer's market. So those were the very first things that Project New Village, as a newly established nonprofit, we set out to do. So we started the first community garden in 2011. That's where we are at Mount Hope. And at 2010, we opened up our first farmer's market, learning a lot of lessons there. Again, opportunities have come our way. So after we were temporarily in this space for about 5 years, it's public space, a sign went up that said the space was for sale.
Right? Yeah. So you're on it.
We're on it.
Yeah.
But they were going to sell it, and it was temporary occupation, and we were going to have to leave.
Right.
But I work with a collective and people with different skill sets. So a guy named Rich Juarez, a developer in the community, always wanted to develop a grocery store. I saw him walking around the neighborhood. What are you doing?
Right.
We started working together, and we, along with Rich, along with academic advisors, academic folks, a cross-sectional group of professional folks, as well as community residents, we began to vision what we could do with this space.
Mm-hmm.
Rich said, let's bid for it. Let's go against the conventional infill developers because we got stake in the game. From my point of view, I wouldn't have made that step, but I had total trust. I had worked with Rich for 10 years.
Yeah.
So we bid. We won. So when we won, then you have to have the money to buy the property. And then the minor miracle started happening for us. We met the Conservation Fund, National Foundation. We built a relationship with them over 4 months or so, and then they made us an offer. If you could raise $100,000 in six months, we will give you the money, a loan, to buy this property.
Wow.
So that was our first challenge, and we made it. We raised the money.
That wasn't a small amount of money in those days.
No, and we were doing rent parties. We weren't some big nonprofit.
Right,
we were a grassroots organization.
Right.
I threw rent parties to pay the rent. I don't think I was getting a salary at that point. It was just the love of what we were doing. But we did it. Some people came in and gave money. Closers at the end, they said, when you get close, let us know, and we'll make that happen. So there's a guy that we met through the Catalyst who came in, and we said, we're $15,000 short. He says, I got you.
Wow.
Because cash and bids. And so we got the loan,
yep.
3 years later, we paid that loan off. That's 2022. So we are the property owners of this property underneath the garden. And then we had always worked with the community. This is a community-driven process. So we have a dream of a building that we want. So, of course, some of the people who gave us the money, one guy, an elderly guy that didn't know us, he read the book, Project 1619. He said, I didn't know black people had it so bad in history. I'm like, okay.
So the book served its purpose, right?
It did. But yeah. This man and his family then came back and said, they didn't say anything. They sent me a check to my house for $300,000. All that check, all it said is get that
$300,000.
Get that property. No reports, no nothing else.
Yeah.
And then he recommended his friend. So that friend is the architect that we're working with to design the space. So we own this property, and now we have a design that we want to put together. And every day we work with our neighbors to see what's the functioning and the vision for this space. We are currently in the middle of three things. One is raising dollars or a capital campaign.
Right.
That's new for us, but we're making some traction. The building or the capacity building for the organization. Again, we're small, so we need other people that have better knowledge about managing money, about managing programs and predicting the future. So we need to do that. That's the organizational piece. We need to raise the money. And then it's the construction itself. I've never built a building. So here is where you work with people. You have to trust experts, build relationships, and move forward. So we are at the beginning, as of today, reviewing a proposal from a guy that we want to be our contract manager.
Fantastic.
So lots of opportunities.
There is so much in that story. And it's such a happy story. And the fact that it starts from literally from the ground up and the community through you taking ownership of its destiny in a whole variety of ways. I mean, literally, that's what you've been doing.
But can I say here, I'm not a visionary. I get the opportunity to be at a table with others. So I'm sharing a vision that's been shared with me. Yeah. Rich Juarez died in 2019 before we closed the deal. It was his idea. He passed away of cancer. And then two other of our board members were contributing. They died in 2022 and 2023. So there's a legacy here. We're doing this.
I remember when you and I were sitting at lunch together on the day that we were celebrating the Leaders in Belonging. You were actually in a very reflective mood that day. And it's part of your character that you're very humble and reflective. And you were saying to me, you were thinking about the people who had helped you get to this place and with whom you shared the success and who had passed on. That was a powerful thing to hear from you. And you just brought them into the room again. And I just want to honor that and thank you for your willingness to do that. Why, you know, people think about in this era of urban farmers markets, you know, I think it's sort of a commonplace that people think that there is access to food and there is access to produce. And if people wanted it, they could get it. Why is urban agriculture so important? And why do you see what you're doing as the social justice issue that it is?
Well, the genesis of the reason why we don't have food is because of a disinvestment in the community. I can look at where there may have been a Safeway that went out of the community, and now it's the Boys and Girls Club, because I can look at the design and say that that was a supermarket. So we don't have the chain stores. We don't have the access to food that others do. But what we do have is people who've lived in their homes for a long time. So if they want to grow food and sell it, they can. So we're cultivating growers in the neighborhood. We want hyper-local food. We want people to know. You know, there's been these studies of our neighborhood, and so what we know is that they call economic leakage. Yeah. People have some dollars to buy. They're just going someplace else. It's our job to make it worthy to buy things in your community. We get it. We're in San Diego. It's a tourist town. You should go everywhere. But you should make a point to invest where we live so that where we live can be better. In terms of a revitalization, we have a game We have a role to play. Mm. Can't others are not just going to come in and make things better for us. There's some things that we can do. So we set about the business of doing those things. I see vacant lots that have been vacant forever or others that have made mistakes. So I live here. I'm not going to make those mistakes. Mm. And we want to eat the food. So we can't. We have to be very careful about how we source our food and how we take care of the food. We're very lucky to have master gardeners working with us in our neighborhood that have been growing food mm-hmm. for a long time. We can really tap in some of the assets that are there to make things better.
It's a very tricky business, actually. How did you come to learn, or how did the group come to learn how to successfully farm and turn this into an ongoing concern?
Well, everything we do is in collaboration. Mm-hmm. So farmers teach other farmers how to grow food, right? We're members of the San Diego Food System Alliance. They've been a great resource to us, to connecting us to other parts of the food chain. We do produce, but I know that if I go to a soul food restaurant and you're selling greens, you need to buy those greens from us, right? Yeah. I think I can compete with that price that, Restaurant Depot or Smart and Final. And from us, you know where it came, and we didn't use any fertilizer, anything wrong. And you help the community when you purchase from the community. So really, we have opportunities to teach about sovereignty, but that all of us have to play a role. One role is to be a consumer, but other roles, as we try to change this food system, are the producers of food, the distributors of food. We're big on the composting and recycling, if you will. So every aspect of the food system plays out in our neighborhood, and we figure we should have a part in making it better. Everybody's got to eat. That's kind of essential. Right. So there'll always be a market for food. So why not do that for ourselves? I think that's
and I've noticed this about you before. You have such a clear understanding of the system here mm-hmm. that you make it sound easy, and it's not easy. I know it's not easy, and I just again want to call attention to that, because I think what you're doing is extraordinary, and it's hard. It's extraordinary in part because it's hard, but it's also so logical, and that's what you managed to capture the essence of. The Prebys Foundation has a view of our work, which is that we care about community well-being. And, you know, we knit together all the things that we do under this broad framework of we want to create a better, stronger community. And we look at that notion of community well-being through the lens of purpose, opportunity, and belonging. It's just the idea that people have to know that whatever they see as their destiny in the world, they can pursue it, that there are opportunities for them to contribute and be successful, and they have to feel like they're part of the community that they call home. And I'm curious how you see your work connected to those themes. And I know you do, because you talk about many of the same things, but I'm just curious how you see the connection between what you're doing and the vision that we're trying to advance in the community.
So I think we serve as an example to our community members that we can get some things done. You know, there are some that, they've abandoned space in terms of hope or thinking things will be better. But we serve as an example that there are things that we can do. If we work together, we can make some accomplishments. So when I see people come around to our events and then they bring their children and their grandchildren, we've gotten to the point where we measure smiles. We're trying to look at happiness. We do community work days once a month. And we're working with weeding and doing things for the garden, but we're measuring. We have a happiness board. So we're looking at your senses and how we interact with the planet and being good stewards of the planet, because that's not something you get to pass on because of other issues. Everybody has to contribute to a better space. And so we take this opportunity to hopefully share lessons and possibilities and invite people to join the journey. When we started a farmer's market, the people around us, some of the people, our neighbors said, "Why are you taking space from a real business? People that can come and get jobs."
Really?
Uh-huh. So I just bought whatever I was in the store for and said, the train has already left the station. Neighbor, we're doing this. We'll see you down the road. But those were years ago, and I get to see those same people. There's an elderly woman. When she sees me, she cries because she's the one for 20 minutes told me to kind of go away.
Wow.
And I took that thinking that you don't know.
Yeah.
And so I saw her at a service, and she just grabbed, she don't know me well, but she grabbed me and hugged me and says, I'm sorry. What you all are doing is wonderful for the neighborhood. So I'm thinking, things don't happen always in the time you think they're going to happen, but just keep moving the needle. Keep moving, right? And things happen. So we've got some momentum.
What do you think was the impulse that made people want to say that initially and tell you to that this couldn't succeed and you were taking space from real business? I mean, what was that impulse?
Well, this particular business, this where we are now, used to be the old Urban League Training Center back in the 90s.
Yeah.
And then it sat blank. This is just, they demolished the building and it sat blank. So there wasn't a lot of hope that things would come here.
Yeah.
But the woman told me, she says, well, black people don't grow food. And I'm thinking, so I'm a black person and I know people that grow food, so I don't know where that comes from. But that we were taking space, that this was a redevelopment zone and we really should let a real business come in.
Yeah.
Maybe fear, right?
And you were it was an unknown, right? I hadn't intended to ask you about this, but I'm going to follow my instinct on this because I think it's important in the world that we're living in now that you said something a moment ago about people not having hope. And there is a... You know, there's a lot of that in the culture right now, the broader culture, not just in particular neighborhoods. There's this sense of things being complicated and out of control. And yet you are every day in the hope business and trying to get people to focus on very practical ways of activating a particular view of the future where there's a reason to stick around for it. Has it become more difficult for you to convey that, or is it easier?
So I think that I'm going to say it's getting easier because, again, we live here. People are seeing what we're doing on the block. And I just gave a tour before coming here. Our five-year plan is on Market Street. We've identified five opportunities to have green spaces, all of them doing different kinds of things. So I'm like, walk with us and see the vision.
Yeah.
So we can show them before that it was in our heads, but now we can show, and then you can come and taste the food.
Which is that nothing makes it more real than that.
Getting a elementary group of children to come and then give them strawberries from the garden. They don't taste like what comes out of the market.
Yeah.
Taste this.
What do you hear from young people about this work?
The ones I talk to seem to love it. They're some of the best people in terms of, composting. They like it. It doesn't have to be the most, the nicest or the cleanest work, but they like it. And then they continue to come from various schools or clubs, and it's their projects. So I share the combination with the garden. We don't have a key. It's a combination, and I tell people where they can find it. I don't have to be here for you to come and do something for the garden. So they're high school students, and many of the college students come. We have a good connection with college students to come and help be stewards of this place.
Yeah, I think what's among many other things that's important about that is that you really are giving the people that you're working with a tangible expression of what it's like to change the world for the better. You know, we talk about that in sort of grandiose terms a lot of the time, but so often it comes down to what you're doing in your own backyard or your own neighborhood or your own community. And you give living expression to that.
Thank you. We say that our journey has been a series of minor miracles, and we only say minor because it's not the whole planet, but our world, it's making a big difference.
That's fantastic. Tell us a little bit more about the other projects that you've got going. And it's a fairly sizable list, but what stands out to you right now in terms of the projects that you're excited about?
So they're all connected around this food system, right? So we have a mobile farmers market, the People's Produce Mobile Farmers Market. It's out 3 days a week. We have about 12 markets we do every month, pop-up markets on the weekends, and then we run two markets a day, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Mm-hmm. Our vision, because we are a self-determining group of people, so we took one of our partners is the geography professor out at San Diego State, one of the co-chairs. So we're a placemaking effort. So we took a map and looked at our food geography. So we share space with National City to the south, right. Lemon Grove to the east. We took that area, we call it the Good Food District, and our impact we want to measure in this area, not only what we consume in better health, but just better use of the space in terms of this new urban ag that's coming. It's here that we want to have a map with dots on it that talks about the growing spaces, mm-hmm. how much produce that we're bringing in from the community, you know, that I just know that there are resources or assets here that folks don't see that we're just pulling together. So the mobile farmers market, we sell, distribute the food, but we also buy the food from people growing it within the neighborhoods, and then everything is local. There's some traditional farmers, but a larger San Diego County. This is connecting us to our other project. We have what we call the Growers Group or the Growers Collective. This year we're planning to have 15 backyards that are growing food for us. And what we're finding is there's a certain generosity in the people who live in the neighborhood. They won't sell to us. They just give us the food.
Right.
So now we have to figure out how to measure the generosity of the people that are hyper-local in our neighborhoods. And then the third thing that we do is the garden space. So the garden space, we grow Mount Hope. We grow quite a bit of the fruit there, but it's a venue for social and educational programming. It's become a wonderful gathering place for people who like putting their hands in the dirt and these concepts called food as medicine. So we do a variety of workshops, those kinds of things on site. And our whole model is driven by community engagement. Mm-hmm. We don't make any decisions where residents haven't weighed in on what it is that we're doing. That means most things don't happen quickly. We have certain rounds we have to go through.
Yeah.
But we get some things done.
And you have this approach, Community Rising, where you activate the community around agendas as well.
Yeah, we just got a grant, so now we can in 2 months hire our first community engagement person. Then I can do some other kinds of things because I love community engagement work, but this guy is great that we're going to hire.
I'm curious if it is challenging. One of the sets of data I'm familiar with in the food space is that the more economically challenged a community is, the less access they have to healthy food, the more their food sources are dependent on convenience stores and dollar stores. It's a really unfortunate cycle. When you've worked to try and break that cycle through healthy food, was there a process of also educating people about nutrition and about thinking about food differently? How did you approach that?
Well, again, we do everything in collaboration. Mm-hmm. So I met a professor at San Diego State in the nutrition department. Her students come out and accompany the truck when we go. One of the things, we have our share of people who need subsidies to purchase the food. So we've gotten grant sources so that we can provide a subsidy if they do a survey. The survey tells us about the population we serve so we can continue to get better. And then partnering with the students, they talk about, because everything we have is seasonal, so we're not going to have watermelon in December. So explaining to people the importance of seasonal food, local food, because they're like, so what do we care if it's from someplace else? But again, the economic factor. So all of the things that can uplift community that are related to this food system, we try to talk about in our visual kinds of presentations and one-on-ones when we're at the farmer's market or the garden.
I was going to ask you how you work with the community to disrupt the cost of, because local healthier food is weirdly more expensive than the rock bottom highly processed convenience food that is pushed in, well, is pushed on the American consumer in general. So, and when people are making a choice to move away from that or to introduce healthier food into their diet, one of the issues that comes up is cost. So you mentioned having subsidies available. Is there anything else that you do?
So we have to teach this or share this, that we are equitable. We are what we call the equitable food-oriented development, the work that we do, the village that we're putting together. And what that means is, can't sell you cheap food. If I sell you cheap food, somebody got cheated. Most times it's the grower. Since that grower might be your neighbor, we can't do that. So what we're aiming for is a fair cost for the food. And what we're committed to do as a nonprofit is to help raise subsidies so that the buyers in the community that need that can use that to access this food versus trying it to sell it to you cheap.
So you create a virtuous cycle where, I love the idea of that. And it's important as an approach because, to your point, if you're cutting corners somewhere, that means somebody's getting cut. And it's part of it is no surprise that it's part of your holistic approach. I'm curious if that the recognition that you've gotten from national foundations has been helpful in raising the profile of the work here in San Diego, either with funders here in San Diego or with other sources of support.
Yes. The Alliance Healthcare Foundation has been really wonderful to us. You know, in 2022, we went through the competition for the Innovative Award, and to their credit, they awarded two awards that year. I think that we were proud to get the award from them, but at the same time, they gave a second award in our same neighborhoods of southeastern San Diego. Mm-hmm. So they then have been working with us ever since because they're invested in what we're doing to help make the connections with other philanthropic efforts. So we're at the point where we've got a budget. We've raised maybe a little over a third of the budget. We still have money to raise in this capital campaign, but we're feeling optimistic. My understanding is the public folks, government entities are usually the last ones to the table. So at this point, that's what I hear. This is not what I'm proficient at, but I am trusting the partners that we have at the table. And we feel fairly confident that we will raise there's several million dollars in between us and having what we need for this project. But we're looking in other directions where we've never looked before. And again, we have a wonderful team that's set up to do that. There's a group out of Los Angeles. It's the Angel City Advisors Group. They are advising us. They came, or we met them, because we were part of a national group called the EFOD Network, if you will. EFOD is Equitable Food-Oriented Development. There's several of these projects, and it's really folks like us. It's on-the-ground people that are changing this power dynamic, if you will, and saying that the people who are eating the food or most impacted should be the people in decision-making seats. We have embraced food sovereignty as where we want to go, alongside with food justice, because there's some disparities, if you will, that we need to address, but we also need to address the power issue in our community and step up and play our role and encourage others to play their role.
The concept of food sovereignty, I think, is really powerful, and it points to something we should talk about, which is the role of systems in what you're dealing with. You've referred to your neighborhood and community as not only a food desert, but a victim of food apartheid. Say a little bit more about that and how that comes into play, because I don't think people looking from the outside quite appreciate what it's like to exist inside a food desert.
I'm going to use this example. A few weeks ago, a foundation that came from the biotech community was looking at us as a potential fundee, right, or someone they could fund. But the questions they asked, we didn't have the right answers, and it just wasn't a fit. What they were looking for was more of a food bank. So in looking at food sovereignty, a food bank doesn't get it. A food bank You know, I grew up with food banks bringing food when we had an emergency situation or a holiday. It is not the way that a person wants to source their food week in and week out. You have no choice of what it is that you're getting. And it could stop at any moment because you don't control it. It's the opposite end, from my opinion, to food sovereignty. So ours is we need to change the dynamic so that we own the system. Right. By which we benefit. And in order to do that, you actively have to be engaged. So that's what we're telling folks. When you come and you help us on a community day, you're not just helping us. We're establishing a new way of doing business, a new way of relating to your food. And we can. We have the wherewithal to do this.
Yeah. Taking this, you haven't named them, so we're not picking on them. But taking the group that came in as an example, what is difficult about helping people understand the difference between a food bank? And by the way, as you pointed out, food banks are essential. We have a couple of great ones in San Diego. We're very lucky to have them. So let's stipulate as to that. But to your point, they should be a stopgap solution, not a permanent solution to the food security issue food insecurity that many families face. So you're trying to make a shift to a system in which people actually can own the production of food and profit from it and have easier access to neighborhood-grown food. Why is it difficult for people who are outside that system to understand it?
So I think the thinking is that the whole neighborhood is like poor, which it's not, and that why are we charging for food? And my answer is simply, if we don't charge, how do we sustain it, right? We got to rely on some other source, and that doesn't fly. It doesn't have a long-range ending to that, right? You give up control. You're at the whim of somebody else as opposed to being able to be self-determining and do what you think is right for your situation.
You know, I think one of the things that America, hopefully learned during the pandemic, when we saw so many families suddenly depending on the food bank, was that made sense as an emergency solution. But I can't imagine anybody wanting to see that be the permanent solution for any family. And I think what you're doing is not only feeding people, but giving them dignity and giving them control over their own destiny. So when we talk at the Prebis Foundation about purpose, opportunity, and belonging, you got all three rolled up in that, it seems to me. Do you ever think about it in those terms?
Yeah, when we have our team meetings, we always talked about a dignity-affirming process, the way that we talk to people. I have a guy that worked for us, no longer works for us, but he wanted to regulate people's shopping experience and say, you can only get this. I says, clearly you and I are from the same generation and you grew up in those lines where they were giving away cheese or something, right? And you want to control people's experience. I don't. I want them to control their own experience. And if the best stuff is early, then you have to get here earlier, right? You want to step in and be the big brother, and that's not our role. So he didn't stay with us long.
That is such a powerful point, though, in the nonprofit sphere in general. It's my observation that people stepping in to quote-unquote help often want to control what happens, and they have very definite ideas about what help looks like, who is worthy of help, when they're worthy of help. How do you work against that in the work that you're doing? You gave us a great example, but I imagine you've had to have this conversation a number of times.
So I do more listening than I do talking. And people know their lifestyles and they bring it in front of us, and I think we should pay attention and try to work with instead of controlling what people do.
Yeah. I love that. I think that is, to go back to your point, it is a dignity-affirming practice.
Yeah.
Because most of us just simply want the freedom to be who we are, and when we go shopping to make the decisions that we make. So I'm curious, you know, one of the things that doesn't get talked about in the context of urban ag, but we increasingly believe is really important to people's self-expression, mental health, physical well-being, is being outdoors. And do you, and I know you're in the middle of trying to build a building, so, which is a different thing, but for the outdoor component, do you see that your participants and the people who are farming or otherwise engaging in it really benefit in some way?
Oh, yes. I mean, we just went for a mental health grant because someone encouraged us to from the county department, because they came and spent the day with us out at the garden, and you just see how people interact with, even when I left today, people had never seen collard greens growing from the ground. It's like, what are those trees? I'm thinking, collard greens? So people, it's just a healthy experience. And sometimes people come, when the gate is open, people show up. Sometimes it's not about food. Mm. There's mental health. There's folks that don't have homes. There's everything right around outside of our gates. Mm. We just open them and let everybody come in. And maybe they don't engage in the work that day, but if they're able to, I don't know, spend time with large butterflies. I think butterflies are bigger in the garden. Or they come in and just sit and nobody bothers them because you're welcome. it's a good place to be.
Yeah,
it's people in the neighborhood, but also other caring people from other places. And it's a good space, good people. And then we provide good food. So it's a trifecta of goodness, if you will, right in the neighborhood.
You know, it's no surprise at all that you were invited to apply for a mental health grant, because everything you just described is really how many of us come back to a space of experiencing mental peace, right? And I'm curious what other examples you've seen. You know, the word that comes to mind as you were talking about that is, it's kind of like magic, right? The magic of owning your own food production, the magic of owning a relationship with nature. And I'm curious what stories you would share with us of where the magic of this has especially made an impression on you.
So I'm thinking it's every step has been really magical. We currently, over the last few years, have been an artist, right? And so painting rocks, we have a music wall where it's not just for children, but adults are drawn right there. It's just happiness in a space. I don't know. Every day is a different opportunity at this garden. You never know. There are people, I speak one language, but are all kinds of languages spoken, and we're doing some kind of communicating, and people are smiling every day.
You said something when we began, before we were taping, that I thought was beautiful, and I have to quote it back to you, and maybe this is how we'll wrap up. But we were talking about doing this work, and you joked, "I'm past my prime, I'm just not finished." Tell us what you meant by that.
So I have
first of all, would you say it, because you said it so much better than I did?
I am. I'm past my time. So I sit in an office with everyone in the office other than me is in their 20s.
Yeah.
I'm in my 60s. I've seen some things come and go, had different experiences. So the fact that we get to share, and we don't always agree, but I'm looking for my replacement. Every day that I'm doing work, I'm looking for who's the next person that's going to come on, or persons, to take on this role. Because we're opening up this door, this urban ag work, and then waiting for others, or trying to build other bridges so that others can come in and continue the work and bring their perspective, I should say. There was a person that was introducing, and I guess this is a person with a personality, so how do I say this? They use terms that it's offensive to me. But the 20-something-year-olds, they relate to it. I'm thinking, because I don't relate doesn't mean like it's a bad thing. Let's just find the road to compromise here and figure this out. I'm going to just say, this person calls themselves a vegan slut.
Ah, yeah, yes.
And I'm like, so the point of this, of eating food is what, right? But they all got it and said that it was that person's expression and that's what they needed to emphasize. I'm thinking, okay, I don't have to buy it, but if it resonates with the folks in the room, I get it, because we're at the end trying to do healthier food. And if that's an entree, okay.
So, well, you're a rare leader who can make room for that, and I just have to say I commend you for willing to not put your personal feelings in front of your wisdom and you know what you saw in terms of the group's reaction. I asked you about young people before, and I think in the context of somebody like you who are. I don't mean to embarrass you, but you are uniquely joyful in the way you present. I walked into this room in one mood. I'm in a whole different mood right now. You have this infectious, generous spirit, which you've maintained through some pretty hard times. And I'm curious, as you think about your successors and the 20-year-olds in the room, what are you seeing in them and their capacity to step into that part of the work? Because it's not just about the task, it's about the spirit.
So as we're looking to put a new person on our truck and interviewing folks, everybody's in their 20s that we're interviewing. So I'm trying not to say, okay, this insurance is going to be a cost because they're in their 20s. Yeah. But the thing is that they bring is, and what we found is, it's a certain lifestyle. It's a certain passion. You can't really, it's not a 9-to-5 kind of job. We are trying to make change in a community that can benefit from the change. And you have to live a certain life. And if you don't, you're going to burn out doing what it is that we do. But every day we find joy in working with one another and sharing thoughts and then just seeing signs of things getting better. At one point, schools and parks were not looking at gardens. That was over a decade ago. Now the city is looking at embracing urban ag, right? So I want to position myself to advise the park and rec folks on what a community garden is. It's not just one thing, right? So work to be done.
What you hold up as examples of success. And I just have to say every minute of this interview has been a delight. And I am so grateful to you for spending the time here today. But more importantly, for the work that you're doing for the community. So, Diane Moss, thank you.
Thank you. This has been good. Thank you.
That was an excellent interview, Grant.
She was extraordinary. She's an extraordinary human being. But the joyful way in which she talks about this work and communicates the work is exceptional as well. I loved every minute of talking with her.
What was your favorite moment or story she shared?
Yeah, I think I loved, this is hard, but I think the thing that stands out for me is the story she told about the neighbor who initially greeted the effort that she was undertaking by saying, why are you doing this? Why are you taking the place of a real, quote-unquote, real business? And what she exemplified in talking about that, first of all, was her gentleness, but also her firmness. And I think what that story told me is we are often confronted in this type of work with people whose initial impulse is to say it can't be done. Over and over again, it comes up. And the real leaders in this space are the ones who figure out how to forge ahead anyway. And there are plenty of stories of people who don't make it, but nobody makes it without having the willingness to move past that naysaying. So that was one for me. What about you?
No, I definitely agree. I feel like We've all maybe been in that storm where it's like, oh, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing. Right. And then here comes someone who, right. you know, and nevertheless, she persisted. So I think that stood out to me. I also love how she talks about working with her board or her collaborative
yeah.
in terms of, you know, she's like, I didn't know the financial piece, but I had to trust these other folks. You know, I think that really represents what we as a foundation care about, right? Collaboration, trust. Really building out a community. And as someone who's also lives in Southeast, I just appreciate what she's doing because we all benefit from that collaboration and trust.
I find myself these days thinking a lot about hope and how people keep going in the face of really difficult challenges. You know, what she was describing about the systemic challenges she was up against is it's not just a food desert. It's food apartheid. It's a whole set of systems that resulted in an entire community really being denied access to and awareness of the availability of healthy food. And she transformed that, utterly transformed that, even right down to branding her district as the Good Food District. So she was not buying into the systems that caused the problem in the first place, but she was changing them. And what was powerful about that for me, aside from the fact that I think that's the challenge in so many of the areas in which a foundation like ours works, but also because I think our society right now really struggles with how to feel hopeful about the future. The world's a kind of messed up place, you know, if you think about it. We've got really difficult challenges that we're facing with wars, with broken political systems, with division and divisiveness, with climate change. And it can feel like we're in this intractable place, right? What's amazing about somebody like Diane is she figures out her piece and she goes out and methodically changes that. And if you look at the history of change in the world, that's how it all happens. So I was just captivated, actually, listening to her talk about how she had done that work and how she thought about it. It's a rare gift to be able to see everything that's going on in the world with big systems and big challenges and still figure out the little ways in which you can make a difference and having it turn out not to be so little.
Yeah, I really appreciated in that moment you two talk through kind of the steps she took along the way, right? The fact that she said, you know, here's some land, I'm going to build on this land. And then the for sale sign went up.
Right.
And then yeah. she's like, well, we don't have the money for that. But it just seemed like, to your point, she was very methodical. She just kept going. And as the challenges arose, she said, okay, who can I work with? And one thing that stood out to me when you asked her the question, it seems like foundations have played a key role in the work she's done, both national and local. Is there anything you would want like our team or other philanthropists in San Diego to take away from her relationships with foundations and nonprofits?
Well, thank you. I think that's such a great question. And for me, part of her story that she willingly shares is that foundations made a difference in terms of raising, not only providing resources, but also raising the profile of what she was doing. So getting recognition, for example, from the Kresge Foundation and getting a name put to her work around equitable food really made a difference in terms of moving her and her organization to the next stage. And I think foundations are so often prone to feel as though they're just about the money or that they're not that significant in the scheme of things. We can be. When we work with leaders like that and when we're thoughtful about the ways in which we provide resources and help, and resources can take all kinds of forms, that there is a benefit that can come from that. And she's a model of it. You know, she is making a difference every day in her community, in part because of the assistance that has been provided to her.
Yeah, it's makes me want to be a better person in whatever work I do. So thank you for inspiring us, and thank you for having Diane in to inspire hopefully anyone who listens.
Well, Thank you. You know, I think it's important to note again that you really brought the Leaders in Belonging program along that helped elevate Diane and her work. And it's an important story to tell in San Diego. You know, we are a community that is going to make a great future for itself by including everybody, refusing to accept things as they are, continuing to dream big and leaning into doing big, hard things. I can't imagine somebody who is a better example of that than Diane Moss.
I agree. And I'd like to point out that our engineer was telling us that her last name's Moss, and it's perfect for
yeah,
me. It borders
is,
on a dad
yeah,
joke,
yeah,
you know?
Well, it's so funny. I mean, actually, you know, what that brings up for me, Crystal, is her extraordinary humility, too, is part of what I'm going to take away from this interview. She is... She did this the very first time she spoke with me, and I mentioned this during the interview, but she talked about everybody who had in her life who had recently died, who had helped her get to the point that she was being recognized for. She shared that credit and that story with them, and her incredible graciousness in general about, you know, literally it takes a village that... she works with lots of people from all walks of life and different ages, and she shares the credit with them. And I think that's part of being a great leader and her style of leadership. It's very inclusive. It's not totally self-effacing, and it's very genuine in sharing credit with lots of different people. And I loved that about her.
I love it too. I feel like it's unique to San Diego, or she's unique to San Diego. There are so many gems here in mm-hmm. our region who don't take credit. Like there are two folks here in the region who organized with Cesar Chavez out in the fields. And yeah. they were like every photo, they're in the photos. Yeah. They don't always get the credit. I feel like Diane's like that. Like she's this gem who hopefully one day she writes a book because there's so much wisdom to learn from that. But in the meantime, I plan to go to her garden and learn from her there.
Yeah. Well, and a perfect example of this was when she was talking about generations. And I loved her story, by the way, about the things she found offensive.
Yes.
And, you know, which is actually a very common sort of phrase among the generation.
You mean the vegan sluts?
Yes, thank you.
I'll say it for you.
You know, among the 20-somethings who are working for her, she's just... I think it's funny that she struggled with it. I think it's funny that she called it out. And I love how she talks about being past her prime, and yet she's not done yet. And I love that mix of saying, yeah, I'm looking for the next generation and how to bring them along, but don't count me out.
No, I think you're right on that, because I think there's always been this stereotype of like boomer versus millennial. Now we've got these Gen Zers in the work world. And instead of like a great war between them, she's like, what, how can I collaborate with you? And I think that is the future we all need, right? We're bummed out. There's so many horrible things happening. But if we can work together, look and mentor people and vice versa, decide to learn from folks like Diane Moss, our future as generations will be a lot better.
Well, that's a perfect place to end. Thank you.
Thank you, Grant.
This is a production of the Prebis Foundation, hosted by Grant Oliphant and co-hosted by Crystal Page. The program is co-produced by Crystal Page and Adam Greenfield, and it's engineered by Adam Greenfield. Production assistance is provided by Tess Kresge. And our new theme song is by Mr. Lyrical Groove, a local San Diego artist. Download episodes at your favorite podcatcher or visit us at stopandtalkpodcast.org. If you like this show, and we really hope you do, the best way to support it is to share, subscribe, and review our podcast. Thank you for your support, your ideas, and most of all, for listening. This program has been recorded at the Voice of San Diego podcast studio.